Hello, everybody. This is a brand new episode of the New World Order, an elite podcast. And it is currently, June 10th, 2008. Just checking my date here. I am very excited today because we have a huge, massive guest on. Huge guest. Very, very influential in the fight against the New World Order, in my opinion. One of the most brilliant men I've ever spoken to in my life. We have John Taylor Gatto on. And anybody who's done any research on John Taylor Gatto knows his works in defining how the American school system has been corrupted and turned into a compulsory, molding plant of sorts, where everybody's kind of just being trained to fulfill their roles and to be useless workers and mindless, cowardly idiots. But I have quite an interview with him today, and I'm going to try to keep this short because of the simple fact that this guy goes on for about an hour and a half, full of knowledge, absolutely brilliant man, so I want to keep this short today. What he's going to go into is the explanation of how the school system works and how it was taken as the American school system was taken, the example for the American school system was taken from Prussia in Germany, because what happened was they had to have a society where the school system was taken younger and younger, started younger and younger. You see, the Prussian school model was the first model ever to employ a mandatory school system where parents had to give up their children and submit to the society at large and give the society at large a responsibility for part of raising their child. You see, school was never like that before in the past, and, you know, families were the ones who usually taught the children. But with the Prussia model, when it came into being, the elites all just went crazy over it. They just went, they were insane with envy over how these kids were being trained in this Prussian model. And lo and behold, it became the model for the westernized world. Now, it's no secret that the elites want our children, and that's why in various books on the elites' plans for us, books such as Brave New World, books such as 1984, Dune, for example, a science fiction book by Frank Herbert, they always speak about getting the children young and getting them accustomed to things like death, to things like sex, early on, you see, because they knew that in order for their system, the New World Order system that they want to put in place where the family is completely destroyed and individuality is non-existent, they had to separate the children from their families and from any sort of parental bonding. And once you inundate a society with immorality, sex, and violence, being accustomed to death and destruction, along with the school system, once you start training and you employ these standardized testing, things of that nature, into the society, you know, that's why you get the regents and the final exams to see who would fit better into what. These tests are all analyzed. Even the college system is a grade system where you have to be graded. You have to be it's not about learning. It's about memorization, and it's about stepping one step higher on the scale, on the pyramid, just like their pyramid structure that they have put in place for themselves. You see, it's all a social experiment. But John Taylor Gatto could explain it a lot better than I can. So I'm going to play for you this interview right now. I want to keep this short. Now, news on my website. I have fixed the website so that now you can just type in, let me pull up the link, www.the-new-world-order-and-the-elite-podcast.com. All you have to do is separate The New World Order and Elite Podcast with dashes, and you gotta just type in www.thenewworldorderandtheelitepodcast.com, each word of the New World Order and Elite Podcast separated by a dash. That's all you need to do to be able to get to my website. So listeners, I expect you guys to really go there. You know, I try to refresh things. You know, I have a recent news section. It's not a professional website, I'll admit that, but it's something that I designed myself, and I'm proud of it. So I want people to go look at it and just, you know, tell me any news, any opinions, any emails would be greatly appreciated. I'm very happy about this interview, and this guy drops over an hour and a half almost of knowledge that you won't get in any public school. So I really thank Mr. John Taylor Gatto for coming on the show and enlightening our listeners. He dropped so many books and so many you know, quotes and so many instances in history. His grasp on history is something that I have only witnessed in very few people like Alan Watt, things of that nature. But just listen to the man speak. I do have to warn you, even though he's one of the most brilliant men I've ever spoken to, he curses like a sailor. So, I mean, if you don't mind the language, you can get a lot of info and insight into how they set up the school system in order to turn our children into uninventive, mindless, drone worker bee insects. So I really hope you enjoy this interview. I'm really proud of this interview, and I really hope my listeners enjoy it. To everybody, I say good night, God bless. Anybody who wants my email, once again, roberto regalado11@gmail.com. Email me, download my podcast, download it on iTunes, download it on podomatic.com, download it on www.mypodcast.com. Just download, download, download. I'm trying to get this to as many people as I want. I mean, as I can. I appreciate my listeners and enjoy the interview. Before I start the interview, I forgot to mention one thing. He starts out in the beginning, and I just want you to wait for the interview to wind up, because towards the end is when he really drops the major knowledge. But he starts talking about, you know, in the beginning, the British Empire and how America got started, and how the reason for that was because of British oppression, things of that nature. So I don't want you to get sidetracked. You know, he starts off talking about how things started off in the British and catalogs it all the way through from the British, you know, and into the American Revolution, the adoption of the Prussian school model into the American school model. And he even speculates on things in the future. I have to apologize, though. There was a beep in the middle of this conversation, and I had to pass it because it was a family issue, and I thought it could have been somebody calling with a family emergency, but it turned out to be one of my little brother's friends. So I do apologize for that beep, and please enjoy the interview. Very enlightening, and just listen to my podcast. Excuse the language. You know, I know that, you know, if you have kids and stuff like that, I don't know if you want them, you know, all the F words and stuff, but this man is very intelligent, very, very, you know, has a complete, in my opinion, grasp of history better than most people, so it's definitely worth listening to it. So I do apologize for the language, but please enjoy the interview, tell me what you think, and I'll try to get you more guests like this in the future. This is the New World Order and Elite Podcast.
Wondering if you were still busy or not, or.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, I'm crazy with work, but let's chat a little bit.
Okay.
Give me some idea what's on your mind.
Well, what I wanted to get into predominantly was basically how you got into, you know, education, stuff like that, and you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Prussia school system, how it was used to be implemented here.
Okay.
You know, things of that nature.
I was an advertising copywriter down at a big shot agency on Fifth Avenue, and, you know, there's no work involved, and the money's great, but it gets a little boring because basically you don't have anything to do but bullshit. So the drawback of the job is that every time the agency loses an account, you know, you're out of work. They don't keep you around waiting to get another account. So I'm going back to 1960. You're probably not even born.
No.
So we lost Colgate shaving cream because we faked the ads. It was supposed to shave sandpaper, but we just scattered sand grains on a piece of glass, and your finger could have shaved that. And they caught us, and about 250 people got fired. I mean, I was the lowest person on the totem pole, so I had no idea.
Yeah.
But anyway, so now I'm out of work, and somebody says to me, well, the schools are desperate for teachers. And I said, yeah, but I'm not taking any ed courses because I'd gotten a belly full of bad talk about that when I was in college about ed degrees. And they said, well, you don't have to. Just get somebody. The licenses didn't have photos on them. Just get somebody's license, you know. And it turned out my roommate had a license. He was a waiter down at the Waldorf Astoria, making, even in those days, a couple $1,000 a week tips. So he used his teaching license one day, and he said nobody in their right mind would would do that job. So there was his license, no pictures. So I put myself out up in Harlem as a substitute while I was looking for work in an ad agency. And if I hadn't gotten pissed off, I would have gone back to advertising. But I'm up there in Harlem schools, which in the 60s were a good deal. When I say worse than they are now, I don't mean the kids were bad, but you know, nobody gave a damn about the schools. And I'm in for a day, for 2 days, you know, while some teacher's taking a rest. And damned if the first two schools I worked in, I didn't get fired from. Now, why did I get fired? Not for doing anything out of the ordinary. In the Harlem school, I got fired for teaching a Spanish class how to tell time in Spanish. I probably speak 200 words of Spanish, but I can tell time. It was a Spanish class. I asked them, you guys know how to tell time? They didn't. I didn't. The principal called me in. She screamed bloody murder. She said I had ruined the whole curriculum for the month of June. And how was she going to explain to the teacher when she got back? I said, no, all I did, I taught them how to tell time. It takes 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But that was the whole curriculum for the month of June. Okay. Then I got fired from a school in Spanish Harlem because a little girl came up to me. It was a remedial reading class. And she said, I don't belong in this class. I can read anything. And, you know, I'm giving her the bullshit that this is all scientifically done. And the girl said, just pick up any book on that teacher's desk and I can read it. And this is an 8-year-old girl, so I picked up a big, heavy old reader from the 19th century, and it opened to Devil and Daniel Webster, which is written in very old-fashioned language. It's a hard read for anybody, and the girl read it flawlessly. So I said, don't worry, Milagros is the name. They make mistakes, too. I said, I'll get you moved out of this class. I went to the principal. The principal was just insane with rage. She said, you're green behind the ears. These children lie. They'll memorize a story and then pretend they know how to read it. And I thought about that for a minute. I said, if that girl could memorize The Devil and Daniel Webster, I mean, she belongs on television.
Yeah.
So the principal said she would come in and expose the fraud. And she came in and could not expose the fraud. So she tells the little girl to fry. She'll be moved on Monday. And when the little girl leaves, she tells me, I'll never be hired at the school again. I mean, apparently I've done some evil thing by, releasing a super reader from a retarded reading class.
Yeah, I understand. It's ridiculous. I mean, that actually brings me to one point that I wanted to make, and it was actual section from your book that I found real interesting. And if you don't mind me reading this quote that you have in your book from Count Leo Tolstoy, where it says, "Take at hazard 100 children of several educated generations."
From the peasantry. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I know exactly.
And you know, just for my listeners, I just want to finish this so they get the point. It says, "Take at hazard 100 children of several educated generations and 100 uneducated children of the people, and compare them in anything you please in strength, in agility, in mind, in the ability to acquire knowledge, even in morality, and in all respects, you're startled by the vast superiority on the side of the children of the uneducated." And it goes to show the state that we're in, whereas we, you know, if you live in a certain area, or if you're considered underprivileged or what have you, then no matter what, it seems as though the modern education system is putting you in a certain destiny no matter what, you know.
Well, it's doing the job it was assigned to do. By the way, what makes the Tolstoy thing even more powerful is Tolstoy's not just some jerk writer. He's part of the Russian aristocracy. He's a count, for God's sake. He has an estate and a castle, so he's used to hanging around with big shots.
Yeah.
And if he now says that they're no smarter than the peasants, you can give that a lot of weight because he knows what he's talking about.
It's a system. I just wanted to say that it was a system designed and put in place. And I want you to talk to my listeners about, you know, things like Horace Mann and the Prussian General Land Law of 1794, and pretty much explain to my listeners from your research why Prussia was so important and how it's affecting our school system today.
Well, I think you first have to start at the exact moment this set of colonies became an independent nation. It wasn't that everybody was of the mind to do that. There was only about 25% of the whole population that wanted to revolt against England. And about 25% didn't want to do that, and the other 50% were too busy, you know, living their lives and working to care one way or another. You know, it was the same bullshit no matter who they thought. But now let's get to the division between the people who wanted England to remain and the people who wanted to kick England out. And I'll start with the ones who wanted to kick England out, because for the most part, they were upper-class people. They were very well-educated people and very, very knowledgeable. But they had bitten the apple of liberty, and they, for different reasons, they believed that a better world would be possible if it wasn't arranged like a pyramid, you know, with a few on the top and a few more, one layer down and on and on. So they were really willing to risk, you know, the rather privileged laws they had in order to test this idea. So that was the revolutionary group. And then there were the farmers who were used to being exploited by the British, you know, and all the various working classes were used to being treated not necessarily economically poorly, although for the most part that's true. They were used to being looked down upon. There was no chance that you could, you know, hang out with the Duke's daughter, you know, all that good shit.
Yeah.
So when the revolution succeeded, you had the same circumstances that you had before the war. You had a section of people who basically didn't care because they worked so hard, didn't have time for politics. You had this chunk of successful revolutionaries who were talking a blue streak and writing laws. It really wasn't exciting moment in human history because they were smart people, and they happened to be on the right side of what you and I would probably call social justice. But you now had this other group of people who were unhappy that Britain no longer imposed its class system. Now, before you make the mistake that the far left makes and immediately demonizes the people who were against, you know, liberty for everybody and equality for everybody, you got to get into their mind and see where the best of them were coming from. They were very well grounded in the history of nations, and they saw that when a nation had like a solid inner structure, even if that structure was unfair to a lot of people, that the nation got along better than the ones that, you know,
I see what you're describing. It's kind of like the Plato, you know, in the Republic, where he describes all the type of nations they are, like, you know.
Yeah, you know, that would be exactly what they saw was in what we would call more liberal governmental experiments in history. That what almost always happened was, sooner or later, and usually sooner, whoever had, you know, the biggest guns or the most bows and arrows and spear, whoever had the military power or could get it together became the boss. And it was worse than if you had a hereditary ruling class like the British had or the Germans had, where at least some concern for poorer people was there. Maybe not anywhere near the concern that social justice would demand, but they didn't look upon the poor as worthless or trash. They had some rights. So what those people, the best of the people who didn't want the kind of government we got, the best of them said was, this is an illusion. It'll only last for, you know, a certain number of years, and then what will result is worse than what you already have. So think of it at best as an argument between two intelligent
intelligentsias, and then so what? But what I
we're going to get up to Prussia now. As the early federal United States from, let's say, 1783 to 1840, as it unfolded, the people who had argued for the maximum liberty for everybody turned out in a material sense to be right. I mean, the country got to be very rich, very, very inventive, creative, you know. Nobody wanted to work for anybody else. Abraham Lincoln in 1859 said in a speech before the Civil War to the Wisconsin Agricultural Association, he said, look around you, he said. This is not life that you'd find in France or England or Germany where, you know, everybody works for a boss and they have weak religions and shabby homes. He said, people here just work for somebody else long enough to either figure out how to set up the same business and do it better than the guy you work for, or they save a little bit of money and strike out on your own. So he said, what we're experiencing here now, right before the Second World War, is a whole bunch of upper-class English men have been sent over here. England paid for the westward expansion of the United States. I mean, they completely paid for it. That's conveniently left out of the history book. So the rich guys who put the money up for the railroads and the new towns, and so they wanted somebody to look out for their investment. So they'd grab, you know, a son and ship him off to be the, you know, the regulator.
Mm-hmm.
And these people brought with them into the United States the same attitude toward ordinary people or the poor that existed back in England. They were trash, they were worthless, they had no rights, you know. And Lincoln is now speaking to a group of farmers, and he's saying, you know, they're blowing smoke through their ears. He said, look around you. He said, people just work here for someone else long enough to get a stake and set off and work for themselves. He said 75% of the whole American population has an independent livelihood. They're not necessarily doctors or lawyers, but they're fishermen, they're engineers, they're small farmers, they're seamstresses, they're traveling entertainers. There's just these thousands of little ways to add value to the community that these people have cooked up, and it's the most inventive population the world's ever seen, because people are basically working for themselves. Well, the downside of that for the traditional people was this. If you're not properly respectful to people who live in a better house than you, or speak better English than you, or have more money than you, what happens is when it's snowing, you tend to get your hat knocked off with a snowball. Or you tend to get people giggle when you walk past. You know, you get all these little disses that occur. And I'm just speaking, you know.
Oh, yeah, no, and I know what you're saying. You know, if you don't play in their little world and kind of, you know, kowtow, they will definitely let you know especially when you're going through a rough patch, people will definitely let you know. You know?
Well, figure out part of why that is. You know, all of us, even poor people, have from time to time had a little more money than they needed. And the truth is, after the first exciting experience of having more money than you need, the money loses its power to do much for you. But what never loses its power is other people treating you with deference and respect, no matter how dull you are. When you open your mouth, everybody stops talking and listening. The real currency, the real wealth is having the high regard of the community. Mm-hmm. And you might well say, well, but when those people got home, it wasn't a high regard. Yeah, but you don't know that. You know, I mean,
yeah. Well, and for people like that, the only thing that really matters is the appearance when everybody's around anyway. They could probably care less, you know.
Yeah, but I don't know if you watched 60 Minutes on television yesterday, but some guy who owned, I think, 59 factories had just retired, and, you know, he was like he'd been hit over the head. He had more money than 10 lifetimes he needed. Like, even hit over that, he said, you know, he said, my whole life, he said, when I talk, everyone listened. You know, they were all concerned. He said, now, he says, absolutely nobody cares about what I said. So here we are, we're getting up toward the Civil War, and we have this strong split between the generations that have followed the revolution and struck out for independent livelihoods and self-respect and so on. And then we had the people who would normally have been the bosses and the bosses' assistants, you know, all that good stuff. And they were, their world was shrinking, and they were pissed about that. They not have been able to recognize exactly what pissed them, but they were pissed. And they translated that into the barbarian inferiority of these people who were knocking their hat off in the street. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because we all lie to ourselves, you know. So that the lie was that they were actually the friends of the people who they were treating like dirt.
Yeah. It happens all over, all throughout history.
All over, It's part of human nature. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is usually when the tables are turned and the bottom becomes the top, you only have to wait a couple of generations and then acting like the other people.
Yeah, it's exactly how you said it. You know, usually when the bottom becomes the top, the bottom becomes the top. You know, it happens all over it. And you're right, it is human nature. We do have to resist, you know, the temptation to fall into that. And it's real dangerous because I've seen it happen to people. I've seen people change when they get things like wealth and then money.
For sure. Now we're ready for the Germans. Mm-hmm. Back in Germany, all of the liberal traditions of the Tidewater countries And probably they got that way because they had contact at all times with people from far away trading whatever junk they brought to exchange. So it tends to liberalize you to hang out with different people than yourself. But Germany is this almost landlocked country in the middle. And Germany had taken a much different route. The idea was you didn't trust people to know their place. You put the bayonet gun, and that kept them in. So it was like a military state.
Yes.
The religion was the army. This is long before the world heard of Germany, you know, I mean, Hitler and stuff like that. I mean, I'm going back hundreds of years, and Germany's a military state. We don't have time at this moment to go into the details, but I'll tell you, they're hair-raising even today to what extent you had zero privacy, you had zero ability ever to complain about anything as long as somebody who was in a position to discipline you was in earshot, man.
Yeah.
So Germany constantly seeing the rest of the countries around it get looser and looser with their underclasses. Now, it doesn't mean by our standards they got very loose, but by the German standards, if it wasn't 99%, you know, you had a catastrophe on the way. The Germans cooked up a way. They knew that older people could lie. They could say they were going to do something and not do it and then lie that they had, you know. But if you grabbed the children, almost right out of the cradle, and you kind of made, this is very ironic, you kind of made the school world better than they had it at home. Sweeter and nicer, pretty colors, songs, free food, you know, all that stuff. That by the time you were ready to crack down on those kids, let's say in our, by junior high, they didn't know what to do because they already had been partially broken away from their own parents. They'd been broken away from their religion. They'd been broken away from traditions. They chased from kindergarten on. Of course, kindergarten's a German invention. They chased prizes that anybody in their right mind would say, but listen, that's worthless, called grades, you know, or class rankings. Hey, you finished second on that school-wide. You know, once you addict people to chasing those rewards, well, you know about Pavlov and the dog.
Oh, yeah, the Pavlovian.
The dog will salivate, and there isn't any food around.
Yeah.
And it's no accident that Pavlov did his research very close to Prussian Germany because they had, you know, they had worked this out partly by common sense and partly by not worrying in the slightest about hurting people in their experiments. So Germany by year was 1806. Germany reached a crisis. And I'm talking about northern Germany. There was no Germany. There were 160 little countries that had been split apart when the Roman Empire collapsed. And they were always talking about getting together as Germany, but each one of these little countries had its own personality. So they didn't want to dissolve themselves into some greater Germany. But the countries that had made an impact on the world's imagination were three little German states. I mean, the size of Delaware or Maryland or New Jersey, right up at the top against the North Sea. One of them was Saxony, and you've heard the expression Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah.
But that was just one tribe out of Germany. But Saxony had, wish to know what religion are, if you're any, and I don't mean to offend you if you happen to be this guy's religion, but Saxony had Martin Luther, who was, from my point of view, one of the strangest lunatics in human history. He essentially hated everybody, everybody at all, to read Luther directly, not what some college textbook says about him. And then the hair stands right up on your head, because you can't believe somebody could rave so continuously and sustain this hate and then shift it to somebody else. But
yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so Luther hates poor people. He hates the Catholic Church. He hates poor people. Hates them. And he sells the little German dukes and princes who run all these little countries. He sells them on the idea that the reason these people are so uppity, the peasants and so on, are so uppity is because the Catholic Church has this international charity running. So if they get in trouble, you know, the parish priest goes over there with a basket of groceries or something, or babysits with the sick kid, whatever. And he said, the first thing you have to do is get rid of the Catholic Church and the priest, and the second thing you have to do is make welfare a state function. So now instead of these people being grateful to some invisible God, yeah, or the Catholic Church, they're going to be grateful to you. And now you got them by the balls, mm-hmm, he said, because if they come to depend on you and you just deny them these favors, you know they're ruined. So you got a hook of obedience. That's how Luther gets started, and how Lutheranism spreads all over Germany and all over Scandinavia and becomes the state religion. There's a real difference between a religion and a state religion. In Britain, it was the Anglican Church, what we call the Episcopalian. You couldn't get a decent job if you weren't an Anglican. I mean, there was huge prejudice that was legally enshrined. And the same thing in Germany for Lutherans. Now what he does, Luther, excuse me, is he says that you have to install a reign of terror over the peasants because they're being infected by these notions of, freedom and free will choice that are in the air now. And the only way to get rid of that is at bayonet point. The King of Prussia resisted somewhat, because he basically hung out with, you know, the King of France and the King of Sweden and so on. He didn't want to be looked at as a perfect shit. But suddenly, 1806 occurred, and all human history changed. I mean, all over the world. In 1806, the amateur army of Napoleon in France, when I say amateur, forget any movie you've ever seen about those days militarily. Every single military unit had a different uniform. The uniform was designed and contracted to the wife of the commanding officer. It was like this patchwork. American Revolution was the same way. It's like this patchwork quilt. And they also were responsible for arming themselves, so some had state-of-the-art weapons and some had, you know, clubs from Neanderthal days. This amateur arm. Oh, and one final thing. Napoleon let the lowest foot soldier know that he had a chance to run the army. He said, I want you to carry the field marshal's baton in your knapsack. And if the people over you get bumped off or run away, you know,
you're the leader.
You're the leader.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll get whatever's coming to the leader. So you had this tremendous expression of libertarianism. I don't mean the kind that the Cato Institute in Washington, I mean real libertarian ideas. Equality, liberty, equality, fraternity. And they lived that way. So when they get into Prussia and they wipe out the Prussian army, it is a fucking catastrophe. Why? Because the chief income that Prussia has is renting out its soldiers to other countries. I mean, half the American Revolution, I mean, on both sides, was fought by German mercenaries. They were all called Prussians or Hessians. That was precious business. And when it wasn't renting soldiers out, it was making war on its neighbors and stealing their stuff. So that was that was the way you got ahead in Prussia. And to be whipped by an amateur army was more than a catastrophe. At that exact moment, the leading philosopher in Prussia, now in the United States you say the word philosopher and people scratch their head, what are you talking about? But this man had the chair of philosophy at the University of Berlin, which was far and away the leading university on planet Earth. And when he spoke, all the German papers reported what he said. And he made, I think a dozen, but he made a number of speeches immediately because of that defeat called the Addresses to the German Nation.
And who is this you're speaking of?
Fichte, F-I-C-H-T-E, first name Johann.
Okay.
With two N's. Johann Fichte, Addresses to the German Nation. And he demanded publicly of the king in these addresses that a system of universal compulsory schooling be imposed on the Prussians, and that the school set out to produce. He was very forthright. If you get these addresses, and they're in every library in translation, you force yourself to read every word, you'll come to see he demands that the imagination of ordinary people be destroyed, because imagination causes trouble. It causes someone to say, I'm not going to do what the captain told me to do. I'm going to do this because it's a better idea. Now, you don't want that. So the school was charged with wiping out the imagination. It was charged with training in reflexive obedience. The only way you can do that is by repeating things over and over. Have you ever seen kids roll their eyes and say, we know that already, it doesn't matter. It's the drill that matters, not whether you memorize what you're told to memorize or not. And the only way to check on whether this actually was taking place, whether kids were memorizing what they were told to memorize, which was half-truths, lies, information that was spun to make the German social order look better and their goals look better. The only way you know is to constantly test the kids. You're not testing them for the knowledge content in their mind or for their self-sufficiency or resource, and none of those good. You're testing them to see to what degree they memorized what they were told to memorize. That's the only thing that counted, even though in the ceremonies, no one mentioned that.
Yeah, it's amazing the way you're talking, because it really sounds, if someone was to kind of just jump in and start listening to this interview, it sounds exactly like you're describing the American school system.
But we are.
Yeah, I know.
Not only are the American schools, and I'll show you how the connection was made, not only are they directly derived from these schools with the same purposes, mind you, but approximately half the population of the United States is derived from German stock. So it's the largest single feeder country in the American population is Germany. So assume that in families, traditions, how they get weaker and they get altered, but they pass down. So you had a population here who was preconditioned to hear this shit or to act this way. So the Prussian schools inside of, first you have to understand, Prussia's a dirt poor country. It's one of the poorest countries. It has no national resources at all. It's just a little flat strip of land up against the North Sea. So it doesn't even have natural fortifications, and no mountains, there are no hills. You know, maybe that's why they became such good fighters, because they otherwise had no other way to, they had nowhere to run
defend themselves.
But these people, became the fourth wealthiest country on earth by the middle of the 19th century. Now, since anyone who looked closely at this and saw, geez, they're just men and women with two arms and two legs, they got nothing, how'd they get so rich? Well, they got so rich because the people who ran the country, the economic leaders and the social leaders and the military leaders, had a huge advantage over every other nation on earth. And what was that advantage? They basically looked upon their own people as machinery. I don't mean like machinery, as real machinery.
Yeah, human resources, yep.
Human resources.
Mm-hmm.
It surprises me. In fact, it's a testimonial to how far, our general population has slipped. I hear that term and I say, well, you know, doesn't anybody think it's weird to think of people as resources? Because resources are spent by the boss, right? He says what to do with resources.
Exactly.
Anyway, so they were able to use their population in a way that other countries, even nasty countries, they pulled up short from doing that.
Yeah.
But Germany created a set of philosophical alterations which they called by the name psychology. Germany invented behavioral psychology. They called it psychophysics. And it just set the world on its ear because all kinds of novelties were coming out of Germany that seemed to work, and they had been derived in German behavioral psychology laboratories in the late 19th century. I mean, things like what shade of glass in a factory produces light that produces in its turn the maximum productivity, the least fatigue, all kinds of shit like that.
Yeah.
So if I say every powerful country in the world, including the United States, began to scratch their head and say, we better get over there and see what these people are doing. And from the United States, a series of delegations were sent. By the middle of the 19th century, Horace Mann went. Now, Mann lied, and if you read his seventh letter to the Boston School Committee, he describes basically Germany's so superior to anyone else in the world that unless we copy what they're doing, you know, we're in hot water. What Mann didn't bother to say, and if you ask 1,000 people, no one would know this is. Mann was going on a subsidized trip. You know, he wasn't a rich guy by birth, so he was having a pretty good time. By the time he got to Germany, the schools were closed. So he didn't see any Prussian schools in operation. That did not stop him from writing this influential report just exactly as if, you know, he had been convinced.
When you say they were closed, you mean closed for the summer?
For the summer.
Okay,
yeah.
I got you, yeah.
Yeah, he got to a few summer school classes, which in those days, as today, are hardly representative of anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but his seventh letter to the Boston School Committee resulted, because it was backed by big money in the Northeast, it resulted in the first compulsory school legislation that was successful in the history of the Americas. There had been other laws passed, but nobody obeyed them.
Yeah.
Yeah, because everyone knew it was crazy to send your children away with total strangers.
So Horace Mann, he started the first compulsory school system in Massachusetts, correct?
He got the legislation rammed through. The money for his speaking tour and to bribe politicians came from coal mine interests and railroad interests. The Peabody family, for example, which today is the biggest coal company in the United States. They put the money up because they needed a way. Here's the kind of history that your school or anybody's could easily teach, would open people's eyes, and they'd understand better rather than just memorize what somebody else's explanation is. The whole coal industry, until well into this century, was operated by children, and I don't mean teenage children. They didn't have the kind of equipment that could make big tunnels. So 8-year-old girls were a particularly desirable form of employees, you know. You'd send this 8-year-old girl a couple of miles underground with a bucket in a tunnel. And naturally, you know, the more people knew this or saw, you know, the lung problems called and the cave-ins, you know, taking children away, the more criticism there was. The same thing, to a slightly lesser extent, was true about the railroads, who were the computer industry of the middle 19th century. That was the highest of high-tech, you know, and it was transforming you know, the nation. It was making localities irrelevant, the same way the Internet is kind of making schools irrelevant, because it gave you access to... Anyway, so we're back to man gets subsidized. He gets this thing passed, and New York State immediately does the same. It's a couple of years, but New York State follows Massachusetts. Then a most suspicious statistic that if you read 100 books about schooling, no one would bother to tell you occurs. Nobody else in the country except Washington, D.C., follows suit. 15 years pass. That's a lot of time. You know, in an age when the lifespan was 62, before any... So, in other words, the product that these four schools produced didn't impress anybody. The reason that the idea spread was, your clue is that Washington followed suit. Money that the government can generate in the form of, let's call them bribes, because that's what they are, and scattered around, is what one by one brought the states into line. And yet, it wasn't until 1918 that the last American state caved in and surrendered. So far from the wonderful idea that parents turned out in the street and cheered about, you know, this had to be done.
It really is an incredible farce that was, you know, put on the people of the United States of America. It really was a concerted effort to... have parents give up their children earlier and earlier, and I want you to explain to me and to my listeners what the whole purpose of it was and how this relates to the fact that they wanted because, and this is just my opinion, you can tell me if you disagree, but I feel like they wanted to not only take away the children from the family at the earliest age possible, but it feels like it's also a ploy to destroy the family because they knew what the result would be.
Family is the great enemy of a capitalist economy, and I am not speaking to you, you know, as an economic critic of capitalism. I'm speaking to you as somebody who likes to call a spade a spade. Capitalism thrives on a Roman principle called divide and conquer. To the extent that you're part of a living community that cares about one another, and think of a family as what should be ideally an intense living community who cares about one another a lot, to the extent that you can rely on friendly, critical conversation from a lot of people, you are difficult to sell anything to that you don't need. Well, the trouble was that the capitalism that began to take over after the Civil War wasn't simple market capitalism that you'll find today, you know, in Peru or Bolivia, where somebody makes hats and brings them into the market on Saturday. If someone wants a hat, they buy it, and they don't want a hat, they don't buy it. Well, it's not that at all. Because of discoveries about coal and oil, suddenly every mechanical toy that was ever made in human history could be made large, hooked up to this power source, which worked night and day. It didn't care, you know, and you could turn out endless numbers of stuff, whatever the stuff was, didn't matter.
Yeah.
But look how disadvantaged you are, A, if people don't want your stuff, obviously, but what about if people keep their stuff and take care of it and don't need new stuff all the time? What if somebody wants to drive a car 25 years, as I do? And what if somebody wants to wear a pair of shoes 25 years, as my father did? Those people are like public enemies. They're criminals.
And it just so happens. Yeah.
Keep turning stuff out.
Exactly, and it just so happens that the type of people who kind of gravitate towards those habits are the people who are family-oriented. I mean, from what I've observed, you know, the people who were, you know, old-fashioned, who would drive a car for 25 years is because they have other things that made them feel as though they didn't need,
they have,
you know?
One another.
Yeah,
they enjoy conversation, you know, they like parties. And
yeah, so they didn't need all these baubles and trinkets to make them feel happy.
You're either going to build life around associations, or you're going to build it around stuff. Now, I know there's a line that connects those two, and people locate themselves somewhere along that line, but the truth is that we long ago gave up the relationship part. That's why half the country's divorced. You know, people stab each other in the back all the time over here, and nobody can trust anybody else.
Oh, yeah. The capitalist system itself is I mean, I
needs that.
Yeah.
It isn't that it accidentally, it needs that. It needs you to be isolated so that you're the you're the most defenseless against sophisticated sales techniques. But what I'm talking to you about was understood hundreds of years ago before you know, these opportunities existed.
Yeah.
I mean, what seems to be Harvard graduate school seminar stuff really were quite common ideas even back at the time of the American Revolution. And I'll give you a one laboratory control group that lives in the United States today who's a wonderful contrast to this. The Old Order Amish. It's some German Pietist religion. It's located from Pennsylvania to Wisconsin to Ohio. There are about 100,000 of them. In the beginning, they have understood the difference between relationships and stuff. So they're totally suspicious at all times about new inventions. Now, everybody knows they don't drive cars, they don't have television sets, they don't have computers, they don't have tractor-driven plows, but that isn't true. I'm from Pennsylvania, and I've known a number of Amish people, quite intelligent. I talked to them, as one guy explained to me. He said, when the telephone, for example, he said, it's not that we forbid the telephone. We insist the telephone be located outside the home, you know, like in the barn or somewhere, so that on your way to make a phone call, you have time to think, do I really need to make this phone call? He said, because what we saw in the English was, as more and more people became more and more dependent on telephones, it was less and less face-to-face contact. He said, so we value face-to-face contact so highly, you know, that we keep that thing at a distance.
Before you go on, I just, you know, that's an extremely, you know, valid point, because I, you know, you see everybody, and you just see the continuation of it now. People walk down the streets with their little iPods in their ears, and they don't even look. They're like zombies.
Man,
and it's it's just amazing. And they, you know, the parents plop their kids in front of the TV so they can be downloaded with, you know, whatever nonsense is on there. It's utterly amazing that we've been trained to become zombies.
Right.
It really is.
We've been trained.
Yes, yes.
That's true. And what the new inventions seem to be, they're much more simply echoes of the old inventions. They may be more efficient than the old inventions, but the object, at least the policy class object of spreading these things, is to destroy the inner life. If you're simply a collection of reactions and principles you memorize, and sensory, I like this, I don't like this, I'm going to vote for Obama, I'm not going to, and so if you're simply that, then market research can nail you down so carefully that your behavior can be predicted no matter what you're doing. You are a mathematized quality. Your life is out of your own control.
It's all about the elimination of individuality is what it is. It's completely taken over anybody who's different, anybody who goes against the grain, and that's why I agree with you completely where you say that the modern school system is put into place to quell the imagination, because imagination leads to unique thoughts. And
now, notice there are two ways to regard that, and I would say that both need to be honored. One way is that this is this endless contest between good and evil, you know, the bosses and the world, all that. And certainly there's a part of that in that. But the other way is derived directly from the sciences. Let me be very specific and give your listeners a reference to Czech. There's not a school in the United States on any level that doesn't talk about Charles Darwin and evolution. It should be somewhat suspicious to people that this happened so overwhelmingly, because for most of us, whether we evolved or were created by some divine power doesn't make the slightest bit of difference. You still got to walk the dog. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Your life is. So why on earth is all of this massive attention paid? After all, it's still called the theory of evolution.
Yes, absolutely. And that's another concept that people just don't get. And I talk because this is the next question. And I know you're. I know you got your
you
book, and I know you got
Darwin here. But
yeah.
This is.
No, I'm not leaving Darwin at all, but that's exactly the next question that I want to get into. It's all about Darwin because I think it's extremely important. You know, just a little, you know, before I even get into Darwin, this ties into the elimination of the religion, regardless of what religion you are, but this, I feel like it ties into the elimination of the religion.
It's
the
replacement.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the secular replacement.
Exactly.
For this apparent human need to have some transcendental idea in their head.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like the theory of evolution was put into place to further categorize people and further, you know, it's kind of like the elites of the world.
And
you
now
see.
We're on rich ground because, absolutely, most of the people who talk about Darwin in an intellectual sense have never bothered to actually read Darwin. But if you read the first book, Origin of Species, people tend to hasten over the first few pages till they can get on the ship with him, you know, sailing around South America or wherever, collecting specimens. Big mistake. In the first few pages of Origin of Species, Darwin tells you where the idea came from. It's in a chapter called Variation Under Domestication. Stuffy words. Who would need to read that? What he's talking about is, for thousands of years, plant and animal breeders knew how to change species in a few generations. And as you get closer to Darwin's own time, they've collected so much specialized knowledge that they can do amazing things. They can create orange trees that also have grapefruits, limes, and lemons simultaneously growing on them. Then they can do all, they can make horses bigger or smaller, their legs fatter or thinner, depending on. So he says, with all this breakthrough in artificial selection and the obvious tremendous plasticity of protoplasm there, you have to assume that with hundreds of millions of years to work and try out different combinations, that this is exactly what nature did. These artificial plant breeders and animal breeders don't breed inferior animals. They get rid of their failed experiments. Yeah, you know, so the gets better and better.
And then they decided to apply it to human beings, and, you know, that's what
See,
social Darwinism.
Start out with that idea,
Yeah, well, you know, get into, could you give me 1 second, because I just have to tell these people to, just give me 1 second.
Yeah.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, who's this?
This is Keith Ritter.
Yeah, Keith, could you call my little brother on his cell phone, because I'm doing an interview right now.
Okay.
All right, bye.
Bye.
I apologize for that, but are you still there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to get into Galton and tell them how social Darwinism...
You don't want to get into Galton, who's Darwin's first cousin,
yeah,
until you finish with Darwin. Mm-hmm. Because Darwin himself, as a laboratory of how the wool is pulled over the public's eyes, and that includes the public in private schools as well as in public schools, you've got to look closely at Mr. Darwin. You stop 100 people on the street and ask them, of course they'll think you're crazy, if they have any idea how much money Darwin was worth, and they'll look at you like you were crazy. Mm-hmm. Well, let's start with the fact that he had one of the largest fortunes ever assembled in human history. Does that make a slight difference about Darwin? It means he hung out, he didn't hang out with college professors and lawyers, he hung out with dukes and earls and the leaders of Europe. So when he had an idea, it immediately circulated at the top of society. So let's start with that. Let's start with this. Stop 100 people asking where Darwin got his scientific training. And no one will be able to tell you because he didn't have any scientific training. He was trained as an Episcopalian minister in the Church of England.
Yeah, he was a spokesperson. He just wanted to get that message out that, you know, certain people are considered subhuman and others aren't, you know. And it's,
well, if you have some technical knowledge about what the Church of England teaches, and even if you don't, just sit in the Episcopalian church, pick up the Book of Common Prayer, and read. Okay, I forgot the prayer, but it'll come back to me. Anyway, read the prayer about how God made these thousands of different levels of life, and that he doesn't want anybody placed on one level to try to get to another level. That this harmony of the universe is because everybody stays in their place. I mean, it's almost exactly as if, you know, you wouldn't have needed Darwin at all if you could have said that the Episcopalian Church is a slave.
Well, it's an obvious corruption, you know, because all of these, you know, religions that claim things like, for example, if you go to the Episcopalian Church, things like, you know, religion and Christianity, you know, there's plenty of evidence in the Bible, and I don't know, you know, I know there's listeners who aren't Christian and things like that, but nowhere in the Bible does it say that, you know, this guy is better because he has more money, you know, it just doesn't work that way, you know.
If you're talking about the New Testament, you're talking about one of the most radical social documents ever written, that a rich guy has the same chance of getting to heaven as what, a camel passing through the eye of a needle? I mean, people really have it backwards. The reason Christianity got so thoroughly suppressed in the United States, it was ritualized. So you go on Sunday, you know, or the presidential inauguration, somebody says a prayer, but nobody actually gives a shit.
Yeah, they don't actually read it.
What makes Lutheranism different than Episcopalianism, different than Roman Catholicism? Nobody has the vaguest idea, because they don't really think it's very important, and it's crucially important. It created not only the institutions we have, it created the marching orders for the institutions. That's why it had to be put to death. The New Testament says, read Paul's letters, and you'll find the single most important Christian of all, Paul, saying, don't follow the rules. You'll never get to heaven if you follow the rules. Think for yourself, he said.
Yeah.
The rules corrupt people. Well,
exactly.
Yeah, you can get 100 ministers, and even though they probably read Paul once a year, and they somehow wouldn't have connected the dots that he actually meant that. Mm. And rich guys don't go to hell.
Oh, yeah, now you have, I've actually...
The eyes and knees. Those aren't just pretty things.
Well, I've actually
this
seen...
This radical, radical religion.
Yeah. I've actually seen the preachers nowadays telling people it's literally about money. Like I've seen preachers get up on their pulpits and preach about how, you know, God wants you to be rich and this and that, but they don't tell you about the all the injustices that are going on in the world. And you know, I feel like Christianity, modern Christianity, has been replaced by
losing your voice. Is there some way you can get? That's it. All right, it's back.
Yeah, no, what I was saying was I feel like the reason Christianity pretty much had to go is because it was preaching that kind of message of you know, it doesn't matter how many Bibles or gold you have.
How about you are your brother's keeper?
Exactly.
Who wants to carry that load?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing. Now, I do want to finish up. It's been, you know,
we're going to get to Galton now.
Go ahead.
All right, so Darwin... Darwin produces this impressive piece of documentation that essentially says nature's way is exactly like the way of artificial selection, plant and animal breeders, except it's a lot slower. That's what he says. Now, the minute he says that, people like his first cousin, Galton, who's a very, very smart cookie and intensely mathematical in his thinking, you know, they probably appreciate the poetic aspect of that, you know, billions of years and, you know, the horse turns, I don't know, whatever, something turns into something else. But what hits them is that you can intercede in the breeding sweepstakes, control the breeding, select the characteristics you want, and breed them. But the only way you're going to be able to do that is if you can collect all the youth of the nation. I mean, talk about a crazy notion. To suck them out of every corner of the country, lock them up, and drill them a certain way so that the deadwood learns to be its own jailer,
mm-hmm.
or eliminates itself in the breeding sweepstakes. Now, if you think that's John Gatto talking, I wouldn't take credit for that. You've got to read Darwin's book, Descent of Man.
Yes, absolutely.
Not Origin of Species, in which he says the Irish are so degenerate that if they crossbreed with some blonde Scandinavian girl, evolution will march backwards, and not just the Irish, although he had a particular prejudice against the Irish, as most English do, but the Spanish as well, and the Italians, and the Greeks.
Yeah.
And the Russians, there's this long list of biologically degraded people who have to be kept from breeding with the good stock. Yeah.
This ties into all the eugenics and all the, you know, the Margaret
Sanger's. It's created now by his first cousin, Francis Galton, and Galton is no shy. Galton also has a stupendous fortune. He's written the only book, almost today, still the only book about the inheritance of genius. I think it's called Genius. It's published in around 1868. So he's come to the attention of important people all over the world, and what he's saying is we're in this crisis condition because technology has made it easier for people to get around, including the biological trash to get around, and factory work, the rise of capitalism has made labor, regardless of its biological quality, desirable enough that, you know, these recruiters go to the poorest parts of the planet over, you know, 100,000 pieces of biological trash. He said, so we're in an emergency state, and we must have this kind of forced compulsory schooling that the Germans have. The British had a much deeper liberty tradition than the Germans had, so it was a harder sell in Britain, but Britain's rising dependence on coal and railroads and steam engines and steamships for its global trade meant that it had to take the people who in Robin Hood's day would have been called yeomen, little independent, you know, shepherds and things, and turn them into a degraded quality of...
automatons.
Called proletariat. Yeah. The way you define who's a proletariat is they have a weak connection to their family, a weak connection to the idea of a home, a weak idea of what's owed in a marriage, weak connections with their children, a weak religious passion. They can be picked up and dropped anywhere, which is the ideal worker, including an executive in the capitalist system, as somebody who's just a bean to be moved around, a human resource.
Exactly. You really break it down pretty thoroughly, I got to say. What I want to ask you last, because I know, you know, and trust me, I would stay on the phone with you forever, but I have a limited amount of time that I can be on here. But one of the things that I could that I really wanted to you know, touch upon is, I don't know if you've read all of these books that take place in the future by a lot of these, you know, eugenicists, the Huxleys and all this stuff.
Yeah, I've read a great many of them. All that Orwell's the best one to read.
Yeah.
Because Orwell was a traitor. He was part of the class doing this, so he understood all the subtleties of how it was done, but he was not a believer. So when he writes 1984, that's not about Russia. That's about Great Britain.
Yeah, yeah.
And all those principles that are built in there are what he overhears in conversation and in reading. H.G. Wells, who was at the center of the conspiracy until the First World War, and then he dropped out, called it, in a famous essay right around the first decade of the 20th century, I think, he called it the open conspiracy. And he spelled out what its aims were in detail, mind you. Read his book, The Sleeper Awakes, and it's so much better than the more lurid, I'm not, you know, playing rank games here, but it's so much more detailed because Wells also was in the inner circle of the planners doing this.
Yeah,
the idea was spread through. Remember what I said about Luther telling the German princes to take over charity because then you'll force the people to be grateful to you? Well, that's what the welfare state is.
Mm-hmm.
Beatrice Webb, the creator of the welfare state, the only woman to ever be buried in Westminster Abbey, Beatrice Webb understood completely how to castrate the working classes.
Yes,
it was by lavishing them with free things.
Yes. You describe it absolutely perfectly, and it just what I want you to do, because you describe it a lot better than I ever could. Tell my listeners what type of Brave New World type scenario we're headed in, where you know, the scientific dictatorship is put into place, and where you know, tell people the future of, if we don't start waking up and seeing what's going on, not only in our education system, but with the destruction of the family, what you describe as a proletariat.
For 100 years, we have been going down the road toward a global government. A whole lot of the attempts have run into dead ends. I mean, the UN's one such attempt. That doesn't mean that you couldn't make a good case for such a body as that. That's not why the body was ever assembled. The idea was to break down the particularities that make one country different from another country. If you read this stupendous, brilliant book written by Bill Clinton's tutor at Georgetown University.
Cal Quigley.
Tragedy and Hope.
Yes,
History in the World in Our Time. You will discover that every major war in the last 200 years has been a piece of breaking down national sovereignty. I don't mean incidentally, directly attempted. You support the aggressor nation up to the moment when the aggressor aggresses against all his neighbors and, you know, ruins their economies and kills their political classes. At that point, you step in and you smash the aggressor. But now what you collect is all these pieces of what once were prideful nations with a history. And you keep running these wars to break down the tissue. It's like some creature secreting an acid, you know, to break down the shell of a clam so it can get in there and eat the clam. That's what the wars are about. And they follow an interesting pattern. Hitler caught on to the game, mind you, and wanted to join. But they didn't want Hitler because they thought he came from a background that was untrustworthy.
Yeah.
When Rudolf Hess bails out over England at the very beginning of the war, he's there to negotiate Hitler's membership in the club. When the British Army escapes at Dunkirk, I mean, you don't have to know much about military science to know that the German armor held the position right over the beach where there's this 250,000 British soldiers. The Air Force of Germany dominated the sky, and all those people got away. Bullshit. He let them. That was his gesture to say, hey, I know what's going on. It's okay. You know, talk. They didn't want to talk with him because he was, you know, a wallpaper hanger or something.
It really
purple.
Is. They control everything. They really do. I call it, for lack of a better word, the New World Order. But we all have known for a long time that the elites really dominate every aspect of society, culture, and war, you know.
In a sophisticated way that's so far beyond.
It really is staggering and mind-boggling when you really try to take the scope of it all in. But, you know, we all have to try.
Now, here's their weak spot. Mm-hmm. Their weak point is exactly the weak point that political science identified all the way back to Aristotle thousands of years ago. The weak point in any management system, call it that, is when the current crop of managers gets ready to step off stage, how do they reliably pass the controls to people who will keep, you know, the ship on course? And that works in spades inside families. If your children betray you, is frequently happens. I mean, you only have to read Roman history to see how often the kids are the people who murdered the parents.
It happens over and over again. And I don't know if you've ever read the science fiction novel Dune by Frank Herbert, but it goes...
It's my daughter's favorite.
Oh, yeah. But people really need to read those books because it describes absolutely everything that you've talked about. It's not more of a, you know, people who are reluctant to read something like a science fiction book because of whatever programming they've been given. It's not really about science fiction when you look at the actual book. It's about a bunch of elites backstabbing each other and managing the plebeians.
Right.
You know?
Or is 1984 about a totalitarian world? It's about a world that we're working toward through the subtlest. Notice, you've read 1984,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Notice that after they catch this guy and they're going to kill him, they don't kill him.
Yeah.
They don't kill him until he betrays the thing he loves most, his girlfriend.
Yep.
And they won't kill him until he does that.
They won't kill him until he submits completely to their way of thinking and their way of,
because as Goldstein, who's the guy talking, tells him, if we just got rid of you without completely controlling you, How would we know if another you wouldn't come along?
Exactly, they have to break you.
Not get caught.
Yes, they have to break you, and they won't. And it's almost like they get some kind of sick pleasure of over domination, complete control. And it's you know, we really need to stand up to this because.
Well, how many board games? Probably how many computer games? Even though I'm not into that world, how many games are really about total domination?
Yeah.
How many times have you sat over a chessboard if you play chess and realized the guy can't wiggle out any way at all? You know, and you get this sick gloating.
Yeah. We really I got to tell you, we really are in dire straits. Listen, John Taylor Gatto, I really appreciate the time that you spent with me.
Well, obviously, I enjoyed this.
Oh, yeah, no, listen, you dropped a lot of knowledge on me, and trust me, I'll be reading up on all those books and everything you said. Would you ever consider coming on and talk about other topics?
I certainly will, but I really got
to. No, I understand with your book, in the future, but listen, I really appreciate the time, and I'll definitely stay in contact with you, and...